Attention, patriots. Broadcasting from the Free Zones, Radio Free Redoubt begins in 5, 4, 3, 2...
Welcome, God-fearing, liberty-loving patriots, to episode 19-05. This is 1905, the fifth episode of 2019. I hope you guys had a blessed week and a great weekend. Somebody said something about a game. There was a sports event, something happening, taking place. I don't know. And I heard it was related to the NFL, which just solidified my resolve to not even look into it any further. So, but I know that that's a long-standing tradition that's hard for some people to let go of, even though it's something that's been taken over by thugs and criminals and people that want to kneel when the national anthem is sung, and not out of respect. So, you know, I was working on the show, so hope you guys don't mind. All right, let's start with the news and commentary brought to you by our great friend and author of the 299 Days book series, 10 books out, including the audiobooks about the collapse and partial collapse of the United States and the rebuilding. Go to 299days.com to learn more about that. Okay, first, international news. We've got a couple stories here. Iran, want to keep an eye on this because Russia is friends with them. Iran apparently conducted a successful test of a new cruise missile. This has got to make Israel extremely nervous. Iran announced the successful test of a new missile with a range of over 1,350 kilometers. Just yesterday, a Saturday, coinciding with celebrations for the country's 1979 Islamic Revolution, when the country really started to turn into an armpit. Apparently, the test of the Hoveyza cruise missile was carried out successfully with a range of 840 miles, accurately hit the set target, it was announced. They also said it could be ready in the shortest possible time, and it flies at a very low altitude. So I'm sure Israel's making all kinds of great plans related to that. In South Africa, the far left South African EFF party, the Economic Freedom Fighters, that's an actual political party in their parliament, in their government. They unveiled Saturday its program for legislative elections in May, with land expropriation and jobs at the top of the list. They said, we cannot postpone the land question. We cannot postpone the jobs questions. And that was a Julius Malema quote. You know, he's been heading that up for quite a while. He, in fact, founded it in 2013. Very strong communist revolutionary type of mantra coming out of those guys. Almost three-fourths of South Africa's agricultural land is owned by whites, who comprise 8% of the population. So they're saying it's not fair. We want the land and we want the farms, just like what's happened in Zimbabwe and is continuing to happen, former Rhodesia, Zimbabwe. Anyway, he said his radical program rules out compromises allegedly agreed to previously by the African National Committee leaders with the white minority. So they're saying, regardless, the economy is in the hands of the white community. We want to change that. Well, you're going to flip it over right into your economy, just like it's been done all over Africa, right into your own hands, and then you're going to run it into the ground. And then you'll be begging for international aid. Unbelievable. Here in with the continued Stalinist type of tactics, here, Oregon looks to impose the strictest gun laws in the U.S. This is being covered by several outlets. This particular article I've linked in the highlights and resources posting comes from getzone.com. If passed, Senate Bill 501 would make Oregon's firearms regulations among the strictest in the U.S. compared to most other Western states. Oregon already has stricter gun laws. So this is what it's going to come down to. Oregonians are going to be required, if this passes, to obtain a permit before buying a gun. You got to get a permit before buying a gun. It will limit the amount of ammunition a person could buy. Wait till you get to the details of this. It outlaws magazines with a capacity of more than 5 rounds. 5-round magazine capacity. That's the limit. 5 rounds. And it'll create gun locking and storage requirements, such as raising the minimum age for purchasing a gun to 21. They want to lengthen the background check delays. This bill was backed by, it came from that group Students for Change, that group that was formed out of Lake Oswego. The teenagers formed with the help of some globalist adults. Unreal. So the bill would require that a person receives a permit from their county sheriff before purchasing a gun that the county sheriff could still deny. And now to get a permit. To qualify for a permit, you have to be at least 21 years old. Of course, then no criminal convictions, no violating restraining orders, can't use illegal controlled substances, and you got to provide a proof of completing a firearm safety course. Now, within a 30-day period after that, then someone could apply for one handgun permit and one rifle or shotgun permit. So, and then of course they keep the copy of each of those permits that are approved for up to a year. But here's the deal with the magazine capacity. If it passes in its current form, the bill would require large capacity magazines to be altered or given to law enforcement or disposed of within 6 months after the passage of the bill. And of course, they're making exceptions for tube magazines for 22 caliber rifles. But other restrictions are capping at 20 the number of rounds of ammunition a person could receive in a 30-day period. You can only receive 20 rounds of ammo within a 30-day period. Requiring firearms to be stored with a trigger or cable lock in a locked container when not carried or within reach of the gun owner. And gun owners would be required to report the loss of a firearm within 24 hours. Boy, you folks in Oregon, maybe it's time for you to start thinking about breaking free from Western Oregon, because they've gone full retard. You never go full retard, but they are. And in Washington, they're doing the same thing. And here is a full retard article here from insurance.wa.gov. Creedler, this is the insurance commissioner of Washington State, earlier this week, on the 15th of January, banned the sale of illegal insurance policies branded by the National Rifle Association and will fine two companies that are involved in underwriting and selling those insurance policies in Washington State. There's a Illinois Union Insurance Company he ordered to stop underwriting the policies, and they're suing them. They're talking about fining them $102,000. Another company, Lockton Affinity, they're going to be charging $75,000. They're going to be fining them. So he says, when it comes to insurance products associated with the NRA, it's buyer beware, Creedler says. So here's the summary of it. The policies were sold through the NRA's Carry Guard program. This is to help you with your legal fees in case you are involved in an event where you have to use lethal force to defend yourself, and this insurance policy helps you with those expenses. The reason why he's saying this is illegal is because you could, in a self-defense lawsuit, you could be found actually guilty So with there's no presumption of innocence here. You're presumed to be innocent until you're proven guilty. But these guys are going to give, because it's illegal, it's the Washington state law prohibits insurance that covers criminal activity. This is incredible. So since the product became available in April 2017, 811 policies were sold in Washington, totaling $260,000 in premiums. Of those policies, 255 consumers canceled their policies and no claims have been made in the state. So Illinois Union Insurance Company said it will stop selling the liability policies nationwide in October of 2019. So this is another attack on the NRA. Specifically, this is a backhanded attack, what I believe, in my opinion, against a specific company. This is fascism. Because now these companies are refusing to do service with these companies. Guard Liability Insurance Products through its website. They were ordered. CarryGuard Liability Insurance. Creedler ordered the NRA to cease and desist from selling the four CarryGuard Liability Insurance products. That's what I was trying to say. The NRA solicited the policies in Washington state without an insurance producer license, a violation of state law. The NRA made changes to its marketing website in Washington to address Creedler's concerns. So, no liability insurance for self-defense, even if it's legal, even if you are lawfully defending yourself, you can't get insurance in Washington state now to help offset the legal costs. Unreal. So let's go to redoubt related news. In fact, from redoubtnews.com, there's a couple things I wanted to point you guys to. There's a Finicum assassination analysis called Courage in the Line of Fire. And this is the sixth video in a series of videos that were created by Kurt Kruse. So check those out. And then you can go actually watch all the videos in the series. And they have a link to it. So go check that out. A great analysis of the shooting involving Lavoie Finicum. And also, after this show, I'm going to play the song that was produced by Geneva Black. It was professionally redone out of Nashville of the... The song that she wrote is a tribute to Lavoie Finicum. Beautiful. She's got the voice of an angel. And that was professionally recorded now. So that's going to be part of the series, the documentary series that that they're doing over there at Center for Self-Governance. So I got a copy of it from Geneva Black. So I want to share that with you guys. It's beautiful. Right after tonight's show. Other news from Redoubt News. The Public Lands Council President Bob Skinner and National Cattlemen's Beef Association President Kevin Kester issued the following statement in response to the reissuance of Bureau of Land Management grazing permits to the Hammond ranches. You guys remember the Hammonds? They went to prison for some fires that they started that got out of control and burned grass and a couple of trees. And they had to go to prison for domestic terrorism, arson. And that's what sparked the outrage in the West, where people came to demonstrate and stand up for the Hammonds and protest them having to go to prison for that. And of course, that's when Ammon Bundy decided to go and take things a step further by taking a group of people to take over the wildlife refuge out there, which you're all familiar with. But he said, in light of a full and unconditional presidential pardon, the reissuance of the Hammond Ranch's grazing permits is the final step in righting these the egregious injustices the Hammonds faced. This is the culmination of years of effort on behalf of this industry to restore a family's livelihood. We speak on behalf of the livestock producers nationwide in saying thank you to Acting Interior Secretary David Benhart and his team who worked to correct the hardships this family faced. And there's a couple other statements there. We'll link that in today's highlights and resources posting. So God bless them. The family is now restored to their ranches, and their grazing permits have been restored to the families and their ranches. So another great victory there. Read that and several other, many other great stories over at redoubtnews.com. Okay, we got a poll. I mentioned this yesterday. We got a poll over at libertystate.org. Well, the last poll was voting on the official state animal, and the cougar came out on top in that poll. Well, there's a new poll for the Liberty State official rifle, and there are 9 to choose from. The AR-15, the M14 or / M1A, the M82 50 caliber sniper rifle, the M1 Garand, the TAR-21 bullpup assault rifle, which is Israeli built, the 10/22, the classic model 94 lever action, you know, by Winchester. That's the one that won the West, and which incidentally has so far 25% of the votes, 1/4 of the votes. The Mini 14 and the 308 version of the AR-15, known as the AR-10. So go over to libertystate.org, cast your vote for the rifle that you think should be the official Liberty State rifle. I won't tell you which one's coming out on top. I think most of you will already probably suspect which one that is, but the results, or at least the results at the time that you take the poll, will be revealed to you. I'm not sure how long this poll's going on, a week, 2 weeks, but we'll see. I'll bring you guys updates on that. Also, from rhinopack.org, the rhino hunters of the inland northwest, they've got their stark, raving, mad stories. And there's one that I keyed in on here. Of course, we're pro-law enforcement, but we're also pro-law enforcement that are following the law, acting lawfully and above board. Here's an interesting, you guys remember the story last week where 4 officers were shot in a drug raid in Texas. But the Stark Raving Mad page over at Rhino Pack, they keyed in on something else I wasn't aware of. 4 Houston police officers were shot Monday during the drug raid on the home of Nicholas Tuttle, an alleged drug dealer. Tuttle and his wife were both killed. Luckily, the officers are all expected to survive. According to police, an informant tipped them that black tar heroin had at some time earlier been purchased from the couple's home. Monday evening, around 5 p.m., a dozen SWAT team members, along with 6 patrol officers, executed the raid. Open and shut case, right? Well, except within a few hours, the narrative began to fall apart. Tuttle, an honorably discharged disabled veteran, and his wife had been married some 22 years. He lived at the same address for the last 30 years. Neither Tuttle nor his wife had criminal records. No heroin or meth was found, only a small bit of marijuana, which is legal in most places now. Not your typical drug thugs. Well, the police report somehow left out several interesting details. The raid was led by 6 officers in plain clothes who, immediately after smashing down the front door, shot and killed the Tuttle's dog. That's when the Tuttles came out of the back room with his, that's when he came out of the back room with his .357 revolver and opened fire. His wife, also killed, was unarmed. None of the invaders wore body cameras. The incident is being investigated by the very same people that authorized and executed the raid. The results are predictable, this piece says. Rhino Pack strongly supports the thin blue line. We have trouble with officers not in uniform, unmarked police cars, and the use of SWAT teams on people with no history of violence. Well, this definitely raises some questions and brings some awareness to some things that I was not previously aware. Interesting. I thought I would just share that with you guys. All right, let's take a break. Come back with segment 2. And we're going to talk about the draconian gun measures in Washington State. Specifically, we're going to talk about those on the thin blue line, standing for the Constitution and the rule of law, saying we're not going to comply with these unconstitutional, unlawful laws, and the county commissioners who are backing them. We'll be back in a moment. Stay right there.
Calling all Liberty State volunteers. There is no better way a person could spend their time right now than to be actively pushing for Liberty State. This game is on. There are so many epic and historic things happening with the Liberty State movement that are defining this current, exciting era in a very positive way. First, we have two House bills to divide the state in the legislature right now that have already had their first reading. We have submitted the written requests for formal hearings on both HB 1509 and HJM 4003. Second, we have secured the permits, dates, and plans for two massive Liberty State rallies at the Capitol building. Get ready to mark your calendars. The first rally, titled 51-2A for 51st State combining with the Second Amendment, will be on Friday, February 15th, and the second rally, titled Liberty State Exit or Lexit, will be held on March 29th. Third, another television poll is showing 71% of you support the dividing of the state. Between three official polls now, we have an average of 73% support to divide the state. Those polls now show a staggering 25,000 people who support the dividing of the state to form a new state of liberty. Liberty State is now teaming up with the Second Amendment supporters across the state. So let me use this opportunity to invite all the other established groups to join us as well. We represent the people who have had enough of not having our votes count in any election in the last 15 years. We've had enough of no representation, and this movement aims to restore our power of the vote through the creating of Liberty State. So spread the word. The rallies at the Capitol are on, and we want every freedom-loving, Second Amendment-supporting patriot there to tell Olympia that we are a new state. We are Liberty State, and we want the state divided. I can't wait to see you all there. So let's show up and make our voices heard all across the United States. Finally, join us in this awesome effort today by volunteering or donating to the Liberty State effort and make a difference that will actually count. I'm Lady Liberty, and this is a public service announcement on behalf of Liberty State. Visit us today at libertystate.org.
We're back with segment two here at Radio Free Redoubt. And segment two is brought to you by Selkirk Mountain Real Estate, helping God-fearing, liberty-loving patriots just like you get strategically relocated to the northernmost part of the panhandle of Idaho. Go to SelkirkMountainRealEstate.com for more. And also, don't forget to check out the evidence of the spread of socialism in America over at socialismtoday.info. That's a website that was started by the senior editor of the Gem State Patriot, also from Idaho. So check that out. Lots of great information over there. I wanted to remind you guys of the 2019 goals and imperatives that we started to get into. Remember, we talked about learning more about your heritage by reading the Constitution and your state constitution in January, and begin the process of reading the Bible in a year. Now, I've had a pretty chaotic January, so I'm a little bit behind. I'm going to be working to get caught up on that plan, so I'll be able to stay on track, and I'll be working on that this week. But remember, we're in February now. So in February, your assignment to restore or to know your heritage so that it can be restored at some point in the future. In February, your assignment is to read the Federalist Papers and if you can, the Anti-Federalist Papers. But the Federalist Papers are really, really critical. And then also George Washington's inauguration and farewell speeches. So that's your assignment, your American Heritage 2019 imperatives assignment for the month of February. We'll be talking more about that in the throughout the month of February. Okay, so let's talk about the American Redoubt, what's going on here, specifically in Washington State, which is occupied territory, but you've got the majority of those living in the Liberty State, which is the soon-to-be Liberty State, after they break away from Olympia, Seattle, Western Washington policies. Well, they passed a resolution called I-1639 a couple of years ago. And there is a sheriff who said he's not going to stand for it. He's not going to enforce it. And there is a whole bunch of county commissioners and law enforcement officers who are saying they're not going to enforce it because it's unconstitutional. Well, the latest, now I'm going to an article here at Ammoland.com because they've compiled a bunch of these examples of law enforcement officers saying that they are not going to comply with this unlawful edict, I-1639. Well, the latest top lawman to take a stand is Grays Harbor County Sheriff Rick Scott. He wrote a three-page letter to the chairman of the county commission, Randy Ross. Also, in Spokane County, believe it or not, Sheriff Ozzie Knezovich wrote in an email to KHQ News that he fought and spoke against I-1639 and has done several interviews, and he calls the initiative unconstitutional at the state and federal level. But there's more. Scott joins sheriffs in Adams, Benton, Cowlitz, Klickitat, Ferry, Franklin, Spokane, Waukeakum, and Yakima counties. You get all those sheriffs. Also, the Cowlitz County Board of Commissioners is also resolved to oppose I-1639. They've actually put together a resolution. So this is encouraging. But this is super important. The law is only as good as the willingness to enforce it. And I talked about that yesterday. And of course, it's only as good as the citizens' willingness to comply with the laws. But they're going to try to make examples of people, and they're still going to be pushing more. Now, they've got more. You heard some of these gun laws that they're trying to push in Oregon. They're doing the same thing this year. And it looks like they're on track to pass them. So even if the sheriffs say, well, we're not going to enforce it, what happens when the state decides to start enforcing it? There are the county commissioners in Franklin County. By the way, that sheriff also just wrote a piece. I've got a copy of it on my phone. Somebody sent to me over private messaging. And it's beautiful. He lays it all out and basically uses the exact same words as what I wanted to cover for you, cover in just a second here. Now, I love how the local so-called newspaper reports it. Franklin County opposes voter-approved assault rifle ban. Franklin County passed a resolution making it one of the first counties in Washington to formally, you know, protest against it. So, over to AR15.com. Let's get the real story here. Officials in Yakima County and Franklin County say they are joining the growing movement against enforcement of a new state initiative that places stiff requirements on the sale of ownership of semi-automatic rifles. They're saying, we will not actively enforce this law. That's coming from the Yakima County Sheriff Robert Udell. Franklin County, their commissioners passed a resolution. Oh, good. It passed. Okay. In opposition to the new law after Sheriff Jim Raymond, he's the one that I've got the copy of the letter from, sent a notice to all deputies telling them to take no law enforcement action on violations pertaining to I-1639. So that's a beautiful thing. I've got more here. Let me just scroll down here. The Cowlitz County Republican Central Committee is calling on their commissioners to also pass a resolution. And this is where the language is essentially the same as the sheriff of Franklin County. So let me read it to you. in case you need a template. And we'll link to this also in the highlights and resources posting so that you guys will be able to get this yourselves as well. Or you can just do an internet search. Cowlitz County Republican Central Committee Resolution in support of Second Amendment. Whereas the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution guarantees the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And Article 6, Section 2, this Constitution and the laws made in pursuance thereof shall be the supreme law of the land. Somebody argued that the Constitution is not actually law, but all over the place it is referred to unequivocally the supreme law of the land. And whereas Article 1, Section 2 of the Washington State Constitution declares the Constitution of the United States is the supreme law of the land. There it is again. Article 1, Section 24 of the Washington State Constitution further guarantees the right of the individual citizen to bear arms in defense of himself or the state, and it shall not be impaired. And whereas the United States Supreme Court has declared a law repugnant to the Constitution is void. You get this? This is a setup for what I'm going to go into here in just a second. And they also make a reference to Marbury versus Madison. And an unconstitutional act is not law. It confers no rights. It imposes no duties. It is in legal contemplation, as inoperative as though it had never been passed. And then they also refer to Norton versus Shelby County, which I would also point you to the 16th American jurisprudence, which says that a law which is passed, which is in violation of the Constitution, is no law at all, as if it had never been passed. So that's where these judgments are coming from. Whereas the people in Cowlitz County regard as inalienable their natural right of self-defense, constitutionally guaranteed by the right to keep and bear arms, and further in its exercise derive economic benefit and enjoyment in all safe forms of recreation, hunting and shooting. And whereas the myriad of measures imposed by government that criminalizes lawful gun ownership do, in their substance and effect, infringe upon and impair the constitutionally guaranteed right to keep and bear arms as exercised by law-abiding citizens. It inhibits lawful self-defense. It does nothing to increase security in our schools and homes, nor does it address gang violence. And whereas the commissioners of Cowlitz County and the city council members of Longview, Kelso, Woodland, Kalamaw, and Castle Rock are elected, they're calling all these people out. They're elected to represent the citizens within their respective jurisdictions. They're duly sworn by their oaths of office to support and defend the state and the federal constitutions. I know that's a lot, but it's really important. This is the really important part. This is the resolution part. Now, therefore, be it resolved, the Cowlitz County Republican Central Committee calls upon the said county commissioners and city council members to declare their respective jurisdictions to be Second Amendment sanctuaries in the protection of law-abiding citizens exercising of their constitutionally guaranteed right to keep and bear arms. And further, to direct that no sheriff, police, agent, employee, or official of their respective jurisdictions provide material support to or participate in any way in the enforcement of any act, order, rule, law, or regulation repugnant to the constitutionally guaranteed right to keep and bear arms exercised by law-abiding citizens of Cowlitz County. So this goes on. And this is the sentiment that we're seeing spread across the state. But they don't care. Those who are resolute to disarm you don't care about your resolutions. They don't care if there's a sheriff out there, or two sheriffs, or three or four, and a couple county resolutions. Oh, great. You can have your resolution. You can be resolved. Fine. We're not changing the law. And we know that these leftist prosecutors are willing to go after anybody and everybody who snubs their noses at them. And then there are the loyalists, like the sheriff of Clark County. Now, if you don't know where Clark County is, it's in the lower left-hand corner or the southwest corner of the state. It's on the west side of the state. That's where Vancouver, Washington is. He posts yesterday on his Facebook page for the Sheriff's Department, giving an official statement. And this just is a slap in the face to all the other sheriffs that are saying, this is unconstitutional. We will stand by to support the Constitution, and we will not enforce this unconstitutional law, these laws that are repugnant to the Constitution. Well, he says, Initiative 1639, which was passed by a vote of the people, no, I would say passed by a vote of the deceived people, makes significant changes to the firearms laws of the state of Washington. The initiative, keep that in mind, he recognizes that it makes a significant change to firearms laws. The initiative is being challenged in court. The Clark County Sheriff's Office will evaluate the statutory requirements of Initiative 1639 and will adopt policy consistent with state law and any subsequent judicial rulings. The Clark County Sheriff's Office will adhere to the law as passed by a vote of the people unless a court rules that it is unconstitutional. So, even though you know it's unconstitutional, you're going to continue to enforce it until a court tells you that it's unconstitutional. That is cowardice. That's the lazy way out. Because you took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. It doesn't say, I will uphold the Constitution. Unless somebody else who's hostile toward the rights of the people choose to overthrow it. It says you will enforce, and if you don't know what the if something's constitutional or not, you shouldn't be in that office. You need to step down. If you refuse to uphold and defend the Constitution like the oath that you took says you would, you don't belong in that position. When something unlawfully repugnant to the Constitution comes along and you're not sure whether or not you should enforce it. So you're going to wait until a leftist activist judge tells you that this law stands or doesn't. And no leftist activist judge is going to say, this is unconstitutional. This is where we need real men to stand up in the positions that they've sworn to uphold and defend and do it. There is something called the doctrine of the lesser magistrate, and I've talked about this before as well. If you're not sure what that is, that's when the lesser magistrate doctrine, that doctrine teaches that when the superior or higher ranking civil authority makes immoral or unjust laws or policies, the lower or lesser ranking civil authority has both a right and a duty to refuse obedience to that superior authority. And if necessary, the lesser authorities may even actively resist the higher authority. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about resisting unlawfulness. And that's what these gun laws are. I mean, where do you draw the line as far as what's constitutional and what's not? What if they pass a law banning Christianity? Are you going to wait for a judge when they want to throw people in jail? They want you, sheriff, to throw people in jail for being caught with a Bible. A violation of their First Amendment rights. Are you going to continue enforcing that policy until a judge tells you that that's unconstitutional? Do you not know whether or not that's unconstitutional? Because if you can't tell, you don't belong in that job. That's my opinion. All right, we'll be back in a minute. Segment 3 coming up. We're going to give some examples about what's happened in the past. People who are armed, they understand the reason for it. And the statesmen that want to disarm them, unreal. This is Radio Free Redoubt.
Are you prepared for an economic, socio-political collapse in America? Do you wonder how something like that could be possible? What would that even look like? I recommend Glenn Tate's 10-book series titled 299 Days. From a lawyer and government insider's perspective, he lays out a plausible scenario that could very well come about if we continue on the path we're on as a country. Through his fictional character, he lays out his own real-life journey to prepare himself and his family for the possibility of a future full of difficult challenges and what seem like impossible choices. 299 Days is a high-action dystopian novel written from the perspective of the average Joe American and outlines realistic plans and action steps that you could implement to prepare yourself and those around you for the difficult possibilities ahead. Go to 299days.com to learn more. This is segment three of Radio Free Redoubt, the John Jacob Schmidt Show. And segment three is brought to you by Strategic Landscape Design, designed to help keep you safe and to help you thrive on your property to get the most out of it for food production and energy production, defense, and more. And actually, they've just added a new service. They're expanding their service. So no matter where you are in the U.S., Strategic Landscape Design can assist you with evaluating your land even before you purchase it, and they can help you create that plan for developing your property to get the most out of it. They use key online data and decades of experience to improve to provide you with recommendations that you can use to make informed decisions about that land from a self-reliant perspective. So helping you guys to achieve a life of liberty. Go to strategiclandscapedesign.com for more. All right. Now, in this section, I started to talk about this yesterday, about how civilians have been used and are being used for the defense of their nations, how an armed citizenry, it is so important that you have the type of, I saw this man on the street interview, a series of interviews, and they were asking, you know, what is this? They were anti-gun people carrying their signs. And so this guy's going around asking, well, dude, what does this mean? You know, Second Amendment, he says it means muskets. It means the founding fathers intended for us to have muskets. They could not have, you know, even fathomed the machine gun in their day. Well, I can tell you that if they had the machine gun, that they would have had all of their citizens armed with them, because actually citizens had cannons back then as well as muskets. They were the founding fathers' writings. And this is how illiterate we are, how ignorant we are of our heritage and our history, because these people, oh, they're just spewing anti-gun dogma rhetoric, and they are not doing the research for themselves about what the founding fathers intended, because it's very clear that the purpose, the intent, was for the citizenry to act as a deterrent against tyranny, against invasion by foreign nations, and so on. So I talked about this where Estonia now is training what they call training a nation of insurgents. Their general, their brigadier general, the commander of the Estonian Defense League, said the best deterrent is not only armed soldiers, but armed citizens too. Now, if you disagree with this, then why would every tyrant or every invader put at the top of their list of things to do to disarm the citizenry? Because the citizens were a plague and a demoralizing plague to an invading force or to any tyrant. So, just from this article here, talking about Estonia, one of multiple Eastern European nations who are training not just their military, and they are building up their militaries because of the Russian threat, but they are training their civilians and equipping them and arming them. Here, encouraging citizens to stash warm clothes, canned goods, boots, and a rifle may seem a cartoonish defense strategy against a military colossus like Russia, yet the Estonians say they need to look no further than the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan to see the effectiveness today, as ever, of an insurgency to even the odds against a powerful army. Estonia is hardly alone in striking upon the idea of dispersing guns among the populace to advertise the potential for widespread resistance as a deterrent. And so, yes, potentially even as a deterrent. Of the top four nations
in the world for private gun ownership, the United States, Yemen, Switzerland, and Finland. The number 3 and 4 spots belong to small nations with a Minuteman-style civilian call-up as a defense strategy or with a history of partisan war. And Switzerland was one of those that was that the Nazis never attempted to invade. So think about that. Poland is another one. There's multiple articles. Poland's launching military training in response to the Ukraine crisis and their perceived threat of Russia. They said all citizens interested in taking part in military exercises will be able to sign up starting March 1st at regional recruitment centers. Polish Defense Minister Tomasz Szymaniak-Moniak told reporters on Thursday. So there's a lot of this. Another one, Poland civilians take up arms as Russia threat is branded country's greatest crisis. But time and again, yesterday I talked about this. I want to read an article to you from the American Thinker. They get full credit for this. It's a beautifully written article, brilliantly written, over at the American Thinker. It's titled France, the Nazis, and Gun Control. Because even during World War II, the Prime Minister, Pierre Laval, later served in the Vichy government during the Nazis' 4-year occupation of France, commanded French citizens to surrender their firearms. Now, he did this from England. Well, let me read this to you. In 1935, French Prime Minister Pierre Laval, who later served in the Vichy, that's not good, government during the Nazis' 4-year occupation of France, commanded French citizens to surrender their firearms. Laval and France's ruling parties feared social revolution and banned quote-unquote war weapons. You know, not necessary for deer hunting. And so they instituted strict gun registration policies. They believed that repressive limits on civilian gun ownership were necessary at a time of depression, sparked unrest, and ongoing conflicts among various political factions. Strict time limits for firearms registration and harsh penalties for non-compliance, including forfeiture, fines, and imprisonment, were put in place. Now, as I'm reading this, remember what I just covered in the news and commentary section about these types of laws, repressive firearms laws, that Washington and Oregon, both American redoubt states, I know it's coming from occupied the West Side, but still, this is today's headlines. Now I'm reading to you from something that stemmed from 1935. Keep that in mind. Laval's government did not foresee the impact these restrictive measures would have on a Nazi-conquered France just 5 years later, when firearms surrender would be required under the threat of death. In Gun Control in Nazi-Occupied France, Tyranny and Resistance, it's a book, attorney Stephen Holbrook explores the impact and efficacy of gun control measures on Wehrmacht-controlled France and how these measures hindered the French resistance's fight against Nazi Germany. The author asserts that Laval's 1935 gun control efforts left the French people vulnerable to the Nazi invaders and ill-equipped to deal with the Nazi invasion of 1940. Plus, simplified the Nazis' efforts to confiscate firearms and impede a French resistance. In 1940, when the Vichy government negotiated an armistice with Germany after the successful German Blitzkrieg, Laval's pre-war firearms registration proved to be a boon to Nazi disarmament efforts. Holbrook explains that Hitler based his occupation model on the historic premise that conquerors who allow subjugated populations to possess arms were ultimately defeated. So, when he rose to power in 1933, Hitler disarmed all enemies of the state, including all Jews. The French occupation was unique. With a German-occupied zone and the unoccupied Vichy regime, administered by Marshal Philippe Pétain, Hitler's forces depended on armed French police to control French citizens and, over time, confiscate their weapons. In other occupied territories, where the Wehrmacht retained sole responsibility for maintaining law and order, gun ownership was banned outright, except for Germans. Vichy France pursued a progression of increasingly severe gun confiscation edicts with multiple periods of amnesty and ever-expanding lists of illegal weapons, Holbrook says. Are we learning from history, my friends, in the listening audience? Initially, all firearms, ammunition, hand grenades, and other weaponry were required to be surrendered within 24 hours under threat of death, forced labor, or prison. Even hunting guns were prohibited and handed over to the French police for safekeeping. In addition, the gendarmes themselves were limited to a rubber truncheon and a pistol with 9 rounds. Eventually, bayonets and swords were also banned. The bans expanded to anti-German flyers, radio transmitters, and public assemblies, followed by measures against Jews, restrictions on hunting, and other repressive constraints. From 1940 to 1941, when the French police were responsible for collecting guns, executions were rare, Holbrook reports. In 1942, when armed resistance accelerated and the Nazi SS assumed police duties, executions for firearms possession increased markedly. To deter gun hoarding, the Nazis publicized executions in newspapers and plastered brightly colored posters with ominous warnings on city walls. French and German police conducted frequent house-to-house searches and solicited tips from informers. You don't think your fellow Americans are going to rat you out? You got another thing coming, my friends. Nonetheless, the Germans found collecting firearms a daunting, near impossible task. Despite the death penalty, many civilians risked keeping their guns. From his research and survivors' responses to questionnaires about German arms collections, Holbrook learned that although hundreds of thousands of guns were surrendered, many French citizens hid weapons, often burying them in their yards or in underground caches. Although the author found no reliable data on the total number of firearms in France before the Nazi invasion, he discovered that out of 3 million hunting guns, only 835,000 were turned in to the Nazis. Less than a third. Sound like our friends in California down there, right? As the resistance expanded and accelerated in 1942, its need for firearms grew. Défense de la France, an underground newspaper, captured the mood of the partisans by saying, "Obtain firearms, a rifle, a submachine gun, a light machine gun, a machine gun. The day will come," is quoted as saying. Now, when the U.S. entered the war, the morale of the occupying Germans plummeted, spurring resistance activities. Arms concealment became more efficient and organized, despite continuing cooperation between the German military police and French gendarmes. The Nazis tightened gun restrictions, issuing a new order to execute anyone who knew a fellow citizen with a gun and failed to inform authorities. Imagine those sting operations when they come. This is a very sophisticated, advanced Europe at the time. No further amnesties were issued, and those possessing firearms were summarily shot. By 1942, Hitler viewed the Vichy government as uncooperative. Holbrook writes, "Although the French people perceived the government as enemy accomplices," which they were, by spring of that year, General Charles de Gaulle, in exile in England, broadcast a call from the BBC to rise against the Nazis. On May Day, 1942, as many as 100,000 demonstrators in Lyon screamed "Death to the Laval" and sang the French national anthem, famous for its call to arms, Aux Armes. Shortly thereafter, Hitler brought in the SS to assume command over the French and German police. Press censorship and anti-Jewish policies began. Jews were ordered to wear the Yellow Star of David, and the French police, under SS direction, began gathering Jews to deport them to death camps. Resistance family members were dealt with harshly, male relatives were shot, and women were sent to hard labor. Two watershed events helped mobilize and unify the resistance during this dark time. In 1942, 12,000 Jews were herded into Velodrome d'Hiver for deportation to death camps. And in 1943, the Laval-enabled obligatory labor conscription required all 18 to 20-year-old males to become forced laborers in Germany. That's your military fighting force, right? Make them become forced laborers. They're physically exhausted and controlled. Resistance groups began urging Jews to arm themselves, hide their children with others, and join the partisans. However you want to say it. The STO brought a steady stream of recruits as young men fled conscription. They retreated into the mountains, acquired firearms, and engaged in sabotage, ambushing supply convoys, derailing trains, and attacking patrols. Still, Holbrook recounts that Laval continued to collaborate with the Nazis, delaying their defeat. Under Laval's leadership, the Milice, a political paramilitary organization, was formed in 1943 to repress the anti-Nazi forces and hunt down resistance members. Resistance groups began to seize arms from unguarded collection depots, hidden French military stores, and local German forces. Most of their weapons came from British and American airdrops, often in exchange for intelligence. Allied supplies were limited by weapons scarcity, logistical problems, and political considerations, as some resistance groups were part of the French Communist Party, who sought a communist takeover of France following liberation. Something else for us to think about. By the end of 1943, news of an Allied invasion circulated, and resistance groups urged all citizens to gather arms and prepare each house as a fort to await the German departure. On June 5th of 1944, the day we all know, the day before D-Day, before the D-Day invasion, the BBC sent coded messages to the resistance. They were to perform sabotage operations and diversionary attacks before and during the next day's landings in Normandy. Although suffering many casualties, resistance groups instigated street fights, including sniper shots at Germans. They blocked some German lines of retreat and provided valuable intelligence to the Allied troops. The Germans fought back viciously and, in at least one case, razed the entire village of Oradour-sur-Glane and killed almost all its inhabitants. Fighting erupted in Paris as an estimated 25,000 partisans faced a remaining German force of 20,000. Hitler insisted that Paris was not to be surrendered. As the situation deteriorated, he ordered the City of Lights torched. The commander of Paris refused. So, I'm almost done here. I hope you guys are enjoying this. This is really amazing. If you guys get a chance, go over to American Thinker. They've got a lot of really great articles over there. By August of 1944, de Gaulle resumed control of France and ordered dissolution of the resistance militias. His order resulted in deep resistance and resentment, Holbrook recounts. The partisans had fought and died for France while he had remained safely ensconced in England. Despite the many gun control and confiscatory measures, first under Laval, who was later executed for treason, and then the Nazis, many French did not comply. The value of an armed citizenry to resist tyranny was demonstrated. The author notes little that correlation existed between severe punishments, including the threat of death, and arms possession or reduction of attacks on German occupiers. Gun control in Nazi-occupied France raises interesting questions about the enforceability of firearms registration, confiscation, and prohibition. In the end, an armed French citizenry proved to be an asset for the fight against an occupying enemy and ably assisted the regular armies. Holbrook illuminates the role armed civilians played, conducting the only armed resistance in France until D-Day and paving the way for the Allied invasion and ultimate victory. And while this was going on, there was resistance going all across the rest of Europe, heavily in Poland, throughout Warsaw. And this is just one of many, many examples. I want to encourage you guys to go and read this article over here for yourself, if you wish, over at AmericanThinker.com. Once again, they get full credit for this article. Very well done, very well researched, and I enjoyed reading it, and I enjoyed sharing it with you guys. So pass it on to someone else when you get a chance. We'll be back with the final segment 4 for episode 1905 in just a moment. Stay right there. This is Radio Free Redoubt.
It makes me livid when I hear the anti-self-defense thugs and their minions in the government, in the media, and from Hollywood talk about common sense gun regulation or reasonable measures to keep criminals from getting their hands on guns. Fortunately, the pro-Second Amendment Americans vastly outnumber the hopeful slave makers. Still, they keep pushing and pushing and pushing. Since they can't ban combat rifles or handguns outright without starting the Second American Revolution, they change their tactics. These appear as soft tactics, but their end goal is the same: disarm the American people. And their sights are set specifically on the middle class. These tactics are licensing and registration. This creeping gradualism is nothing short of tyranny, and has historically always led to confiscation. If they were honest with you and me, and especially themselves, they would acknowledge their measures do nothing to reduce crime. But then, reducing crime was never their goal. Vladimir Lenin said, "A system of licensing and registration is the perfect device to deny gun ownership to the bourgeoisie. But I say, never register or license your arms, and never give them up." I'm Violette Sabo, with points to ponder, words to live by, in ideals which define us.
This is the fourth and final segment here at Radio Free Redoubt. And segment 4 is brought to you by Works Holsters, Works LLC, making Kydex custom holsters for your handguns and your magazines, inside the waistband, outside the waistband, whatever you want. And don't forget to support the Liberty State effort by ordering. You can also get the Liberty State logo, the seal, the state seal, and or the state flag on your custom holster. So ask about that. And part of the proceeds go to libertystate.org. That's works.com, W-E-R-K-Z.com. All right, now, once again, I want to reiterate our 2019 imperatives. I already touched on this. We're going to be reading the Federalist Papers and George Washington's inaugural address and farewell address. But I wanted to talk about a couple of other things before I read this last article to you that I touched on yesterday. Self-reliance. For whatever's coming, we need to be able to be self-reliant. Look at the examples of what's going on in Venezuela. How much is enough to save up? How much food? Well, you think 30 days is enough? You think 90 days is enough? What's going on over there? Over a year now? A year and a half? That's been going on with those type of food shortages and rationing. Food being used as a weapon. So I would say every family should have enough to support your whole family for 1 year. And then, of course, offset that with the ability to, produce your own, have a small garden, and take advantage of opportunities when the government does come and issue bread to your community. But you're not in a position where you have to risk your life to get it. So start with a year. That's my recommendation. Or like in Glenn Tate, when he covers his books, covers that in his books. Start off with a week worth, and then a month. And then 90 days, and then 6 months, and keep expanding it. But I think you should set your sights on setting the goal, at least for at some point within the next year, you should have a year's worth saved up. It's pretty easy to do, actually, especially with staples. All right. And of course, water is a huge one. You have to be able to produce. You cannot store enough water. So you need to produce the ability to treat and purify it and filter the water that you need. Arming yourselves, one combat rifle, one battle rifle, at least, in my opinion, at least for every male in your family. But personally, I think every single individual, even if they're too young to hold one, even, it's something you can pass down to them. But you need to have at least one battle rifle in your family, at the very, very least. I recommend 21 magazines. That's 3 times 7 mags, 7 mags being a basic combat load. And so you've got 2 other basic combat loads all ready to go in magazines. And I'm talking about the scary kind, you know, 20 to 30 round magazines, depending on what you're carrying. And you should have 1,000 rounds of ammo above and beyond that, 1,000 rounds of ammo for each battle rifle. And 1 handgun for each member of your family as well. Also, get training. Get trained. There's so many people that's got all the gear and they got the toys, but they're not trained, whether it's communications or whether it's anything, your compass or your rifle. Get training. Get formal training, especially with your firearms. Okay. Now, you know, and Glenn Tate and Shelby Gallagher do a great podcast now, Prepping 2.0. It's one of several podcasts out there, but we know and trust Glenn, and we've gotten to know Shelby. So, you know, they've both written books on this. They've done extensive research on this. Now they're talking about it in Prepping 2.0, so go check out that podcast as well. Now, I want to reflect back on this article from yesterday at Redoubt News. Actually, it came out a couple days ago, but I talked about this yesterday. And that is the Idaho Abortion Human Rights Act, Equality for the Preborn. And this is written to you by a very rare commodity that we have as patriots, and that is Christian patriot elected officials that are in session right now in the legislature, Representative Heather Scott and Representative John Green, both of them from North Idaho. They're down in Boise right now, and they're fighting for the things that you and I care about. So here's something in particular that they submitted for Redoubt News, and I would love to see this spread far and wide, and especially if you are in Idaho, you need to get behind this, you need to get a hold of your elected officials and tell them to support this. So I want to read this article to you from RedoubtNews.com, yet another great piece of information and research passed on by Redoubt News. So here we go. On December 18th, 2012, Jeremy Keith Swanson clocked out of work, drove to Priest River, Idaho, and purchased an ice pick at a local hardware store. Upon arriving home, Jeremy then argued with his 27-year-old wife, Jennifer, before she ultimately retired to their bedroom. He later attacked her with the ice pick and a kitchen knife, stabbing her 37 times, which resulted in her death. At the time that she died, Jennifer was about 15 to 18 weeks pregnant with their preborn child. This is a tectonic shift in the abortion debate, as you will know as I go through this. Since Idaho Code 18-4001 already defines murder as the unlawful killing of a human being, including but not limited to a human embryo or fetus, with malice aforethought or the intentional application of torture to a human being, which results in the death of a human being. Jeremy Swanson was charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder, one for the death of his wife and one for the death of his preborn child. Swanson ultimately entered into a plea agreement with the state, which stepped down the fetal first-degree murder charge to murder in the second degree, but still murder. In exchange for the pleas, the prosecution agreed not to seek charge enhancements or the death penalty. Bonner County Prosecutor Lewis Marshall recommended a life sentence without the possibility of parole due to the ferocious and premeditated nature of the attack. There's no way to put a meaning on the evil that occurred that night in December, he said. At his sentencing, Judge Benjamin Simpson found that the case was one of clear premeditation. He said these two crimes were committed with unspeakable violence, and Swanson was sentenced to a life sentence for the first-degree murder of his wife and to a separate life sentence for the second-degree murder of his preborn child. There is no possibility of parole. Now, in this criminal case, the Idaho statutes had it right. Swanson should not have been allowed to kill his preborn child, and in doing so, he was rightly charged with first-degree murder. And due to the premeditated, heinous nature of the crime, he was rightly punished with a severe penalty. On that same day in 2012, Ms. Swanson, or any other female Idaho resident, could have premeditatively scheduled an appointment at an abortion facility and had the same preborn baby killed by brutal dismemberment. And because of Idaho Code 18-40-16, she could not have been prosecuted for murdering her child. The Idaho statutes do not say that her abortion would not be considered a murder, but the statutes simply prohibit her prosecution for such a premeditated, heinous crime. And Idaho Statute 32-102 says a child conceived but not yet born is to be deemed an existing person. Now, it is not a United States Supreme Court opinion from 1973 that makes abortion legal in Idaho, but rather, it is Idaho statutes that make exceptions for murder. There is a special class of individuals who can murder other individuals without fear of prosecution. And because there is no punishment, Idaho women can avail themselves of the opportunity to kill their preborn children with impunity 1,750 times every year. Ecclesiastes 8:11 tells us, because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. The Idaho Abortion Human Rights Act is a bill being introduced by Idaho State Representatives Heather Scott of Blanchard and John Green of Rathdrum. The act honors Article 1, Section 18 of the Idaho Constitution, which states, in part, that courts of justice shall be open to every person, and right and justice shall be administered without denial, delay, or prejudice. Now, separately, Idaho Code 32-102 states, in part, that a child conceived but not yet born is to be deemed an existing person. The Idaho Abortion Human Rights Act is aimed at the heart of the issue regarding abortion. The Article 1 of Section 1 of the Idaho Constitution states all men having certain inalienable rights, among which are enjoying and defending life and securing safety. Which also supports the Second Amendment, securing safety, right? You can always lean on that. Separate issue, but by allowing legal access to abortion in Idaho statutes, Idaho is currently alienating what are supposed to be the inalienable rights of all persons in the jurisdiction of Idaho. The act also strikes at the core of the abortion issue as to why abortion is wrong, that it is murder. In footnote 54 of the Roe v. Wade decision, Justice Harry Blackmun, delivering the opinion of the court, wrote that Texas's attempt to argue to the Supreme Court the right to life of the fetus failed because Texas did not itself treat the fetus as a person in its own statutes when it allowed exceptions for abortion and when it did not treat the mother securing the abortion as liable for any crime. The Idaho Abortion Human Rights Act is the first legislative proposal in Idaho since Roe v. Wade, without exceptions, that honors the preborn persons as worthy as the rest of us in regards to fundamental human rights and equal protection under the law. The act is also not an attempt to establish a test case for federal judicial review. Rather, It recognizes that the courts render opinions that are sometimes unconstitutional, and that the state of Idaho and its officers are bound by oath to original interpretation of the constitutions. Idaho, as a sovereign state within the federal republic, has the fundamental duty to act as a check and a balance to the federal government when it errs on constitutional issues. The executive and legislative branches are to act as a check and a balance against unconstitutional errors of the judiciary. In fact, courts don't make laws. Legislatures do. A recent example of Idaho exercising its sovereign status against federal overreach can be found in Idaho Senate Bill SB 1332 from back in 2014, the Federal Firearm Magazine and Register Ban Enforcement Act. This act passed unanimously in the Idaho House and Senate and was signed into law by then Governor Butch Otter. SB 1332 now is an Idaho code, coded 183315B, directs Idaho officials to ignore or defy federal laws that are contrary to the Idaho Constitution's Article 1, Section 11 regarding firearms. In the same fashion, the 2019 Idaho Abortion Human Rights Act asserts Idaho's authority to ignore or defy federal laws or court opinions that are clearly contrary to the rights contained in the Idaho Constitution. And then it says, if you want more information about the 2019 Idaho Abortion Human Rights Act, please contact Idaho State Representative Heather Scott or Idaho State Representative John Green, and their emails are here. So you can go to redoubtnews.com. You can look at this article and click on this link, or you can find it in our highlights and resources posting. Give us about 48 hours to get that posted. But this is why we need to know our heritage and know our history and know who we are as Americans and as citizens of the individual states that we live in, because they are federal republics. They are independent states. And you have to know your state constitution. That's why I signed that to you this month to learn, or last month, to read the United States Constitution and to read your state's constitution, because there could be a victory here. There's a very strong chance of a victory here based on their opinions, the articles, or the court's opinion in Roe versus Wade as to why this law was inconsistent, because Texas had no statute that they were holding to. They were making an exception in the case for abortions. Well, in Idaho, it's not the exception. It is the rule. The unborn are to be treated as existing humans. So this is a beautiful strategy. It has a very strong chance of prevailing. And I'm going to pray that it does. So with that, guys, I know there's a lot of information, but I think there's really good stuff to cover. I hope you enjoyed this. I hope it was a blessing to you. Thank you guys for your continued support and your prayers for me and for all of the partisans helping with Radio Free Redoubt and Amron. And we just appreciate that. So you guys have a blessed week. This is Radio Free Redoubt. I'm John Jacob Schmidt. And if you're a God-fearing, liberty-loving patriot, well, my name is your name too. Good night.